a sustainable economy means that people are happy and well-fed and are have access to democracy, have the ability to flourish. They live safe lives. They have high levels of satisfaction. They have mental health. They have physical health. They have community. They have spirituality. Their basic needs are met and more. That should be the objective of an economy.
Right.
Those conversations don't even enter into most discussions of economics. If you turn on CBC, you turn on MSNBC or whatever it may be, mm-hmm. it's stock market, it's GDP growth, it's trade imbalance. We're not talking about the actual things that we value. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the busyness of the economy.
Right.
And in a very narrowly quantified way that actually misses the target completely on what it is that we value. I think most people don't really care at the end of the day if the economy is bigger. What they care about is that their lives are good or their lives are better.
Hey everyone, welcome to Your Forest. I'm Matthew Christoph. On this podcast, we talk about the environment and the science of sustainability. And that could not be more true than today. So today's guest is Jeremy L. Caradona. Jeremy has a PhD in the history of scientific, environmental, and political thought, and teaches environmental studies and human dimensions of climate change at the University of Victoria. So he's obsessed with sustainability, how it applies to our everyday lives, how it applies to food systems, to forestry, to renewable resources, to renewable energy, that kind of stuff. And he wrote this awesome book called Sustainability: A History. It was really such a well done book. I really appreciated all the thought and research he put into it. And it really lays out the history of sustainability from, the 1700s up until today. And the lessons that we learned along the way that we've kind of forgotten now and where we're going with sustainability, how we can adjust our society to be more sustainable in the long run and why that's beneficial for everybody, including it's beneficial for the economy. It's beneficial for human health. It's beneficial for human happiness, for the success of a nation and, a group in the long term, individually in the long term. It's good for social justice. Sustainability is really all encompassing. It encompasses all aspects of life. And we just need to start to get people to understand that a little bit better. And this book does a great job of tying those things together, tying social justice, economic well-being, environmental protection and long-term success of the human race all together into one thing. And it's hard to argue against. It's really well done. So it was a great conversation. You guys are really going to like it. West Fraser is the number one sponsor for this podcast. Without them, I really could not have these conversations, the way I've been having them. They provide an opportunity for me to spread the word a little more and kind of do this better. So I appreciate all of their help. Thank you so much. And also Greenlink Forestry has also been with me since the beginning, and I couldn't thank them enough for the opportunities they provided me. And lastly, Damaged Timber. Damaged Timber is a local company out of Edmonton, Alberta, and he is selling all kinds of stuff like hats and clothes and that kind of stuff. But also he is selling these really, really awesome butcher boards and cutting boards and charcuterie boards made out of wood from wildfire burnt areas. So literally, damaged timber. He's pulling damaged timber that's been burnt from the bush, turning it into something you can put in your kitchen. It's super neat. Definitely check it out, damagedtimber.com. And he puts 10% of everything he sells towards a scholarship for environmental sciences. So that's where that ties in here. And, put in Your Forest 10 at checkout to save 10%. And that's about it. So here we go. Let's start the episode talking about sustainability as an idea and how we can improve upon it with Jeremy L. Caradona. Here we go. So I found your book super, super fascinating. Like,
thank you.
Some of the stuff, especially talking about what I appreciated a lot about it, was not just the history, but this, when you were talking about the political history and the economic history behind sustainability and, you know, how we measure success in a nation and that kind of stuff. But the book was great. I really, really enjoyed it. And it's one of those ones that I'm going to go back and listen to again, probably in a couple of years once I've forgotten the lessons.
Well, you can also always phone me up and I'm happy to chat.
Yeah, no,
You know, that book was part of a trajectory of my life too. It was like a certain moment in my life because I guess I should probably tell you this. I mean, I might have mentioned this on other podcasts, but just for your listeners, I've had a very unusual life path because, I mean, first of all, I'm from the States. I grew up in Seattle and in fact, I've been completely distracted the last couple of days by what's going on down there. I mean, it's just disastrous.
No kidding.
It's been a disastrous number of years and really upsetting for me and my family. And, my mother's actually trying to get out of the U.S. right now because for obvious reasons, but
yeah, no kidding.
You know, what to say about that? Yeah, it just, there's a lot to say about that, but essentially I'm from Seattle and I got my graduate degree at Johns Hopkins. And then I started writing my dissertation, which was on 18th century French Enlightenment history and particularly on the involvement of the average person in intellectual life. I was particularly interested in that. And the material that I used, I went to about 30 different provincial towns and I dug through all of these municipal archives and departmental archives and found all this material that had never been used by historians to show that there were these essay competitions that were used for hundreds of years in Europe to get people involved in public debate, essentially. And some of the topics were very abstruse and philosophical and poetical and that sort of thing and literary, but increasingly they're on really, really hot button topics of the day. I mean, topics on like reform of penal code, the abolition of slavery, whether or not women should have more rights, or there should be equality between the sexes, tax reform, you name it. And then also environmental topics too, like forestry. Right. So I've actually, I draw on that a little bit in the book, but I've written other, you know, my dissertation, which became my first book and some other articles I published go into it more, but there was a crisis around forests in the 18th century because we tend to think that we invented deforestation, but it really is a 2000 year, 2500 year problem that, that, you know, at least certain parts of the world have been dealing with. I mean, France had, I think, 16% of its original forest cover by the 18th century, vis-a-vis antiquity.
That's something else.
So I got really interested in environmental topics. In any case, I started writing my dissertation. Two chapters in, on a lark, I applied for a job, a tenure track job at the University of Alberta. And I probably couldn't have even found Alberta on the map at the time. You know, as an American, they don't tell us that much. They didn't tell us that much about Canada growing up. We knew there was BC. BC was directly north of Washington. And then on the other side, there was like Toronto and Quebec and stuff. But everything in the middle was like, I don't know what's going on there.
I've got some similar stories that,
right. It's like finding Kansas on a map.
We don't like the headlines a lot.
So anyway, I ended up getting this job at the University of Alberta. My wife and I moved there. We have kids. And I'm chugging along. You know, I'm making a good salary at the U of A. I get tenure. I'm one of the youngest people in the Department of History to ever get tenure. I was in my 20s, early 30s, very early 30s.
Nice. Humble brag.
But you know what? Here's the point, though, is that like it wasn't satisfying for me at all. And this is a sort of a theme in my life, which is that I have objectively the trappings of success, and yet it doesn't satisfy me. And I don't feel any deep moral satisfaction from it. And at the same time, I started learning about climate change. I mean, I'd always known a bit about it, but it just came onto my radar more and more.
What year was this, just for context?
This would have been 2012.
Okay.
And I just had this, you know, St. Paul on the road to Damascus kind of moment where I was like, I'm wasting my life. Mm-hmm. And not only am I wasting my life, I'm wasting everyone else's time and resources, because as, first of all, a white person and a male and a North American and a highly educated person, I didn't grow up in a family of means by any means, but nonetheless, white, male, North American, you know, I had my university largely paid for. In fact, I still have some undergraduate student loans, but my graduate schooling was completely paid for by Hopkins. Got a Fulbright, you know, became a professor. I'm in the elite. I'm in the elite of the academic world, if not in terms of earnings.
Sure.
And what am I doing? You know, I'm writing historical works that are interesting and important. I'm not gonna certainly criticize the profession of history. I'm a major defender of history. But on the one hand, you've got this existential crisis. In fact, an overlapping series of ecological crises, including deforestation, including loss of species, including biodiversity, habitat loss, ecosystem services, climate change, mm-hmm. on and on. Mm-hmm. On the one hand. On the other hand, I'm writing abstruse historical works that are read by 50 people and making six figures. And it just, I couldn't square the circle. I just felt like, and I've mentioned this before, but there's this quote from Voltaire that's always had a big impact on me. And that is that every person is guilty of the good they do not do. Mm. And I felt like there was all this good I could be doing, but I wasn't doing it. Mm. And so, I just realized that I didn't want to be writing academic works for 50 people anymore. And I also didn't want to be flying around North America and the world, which, by the way, academics do all the time, to deliver papers, which could be done remotely and out of which I got very little. So I was also somewhat disgruntled on that end. And so the first thing I started to do was just shift my research towards areas that I thought were more practical for humans.
Sure.
And for a general readership. And so that's when, and at the same time, I was getting really involved in the sustainability movement at the U of A. I was sitting on committees there and working with the Office of Sustainability and helping to write policy for the university. Mm-hmm. So out of that research, then combined with my earlier research and my dissertation, just recognizing that the word sustainability, for instance, came from the 18th century. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew already that the origins of sustainability, that concept, go back to forestry, go back to the early 18th century into the Holy Roman Empire, what's now Germany. And so it all came together, and I wrote my second book, Sustainability History, and it sold very widely and sort of put me on the map in a lot of ways and changed my life. And not long after that, I decided to go down to work part-time, and I started to move my life and my family over to BC. And I worked a 0.5 at U of A for a few more years, but eventually I just left. Mm-hmm. And I did a couple of different things over here in BC, including own an organic food company.
Okay.
Which ended up having a big impact on me, because my third book is actually a handbook that shows farmers how to transition from conventional to organic vegetable production.
I saw that. Yeah. I haven't read it, yeah. But I did see it on your website there.
So,
yeah.
My career went in that direction. And I also just realized that my passion, actually, I won't say it's my passion. History is my passion. Mm. My calling, my duty. That's the word I'm looking for. Right. My duty, I feel, as a well-educated person who's aware of what's going on in the world, my duty is to work on climate change.
Yeah.
I believe, because that is the big issue facing all of us. And of course, climate change has a lot of different dimensions to it. So I started to get back into academia part-time, and I started teaching in environmental studies at UVic, and have been teaching there for the last 4 or 5 years, teaching courses on sustainability and climate change and food systems and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then last year I decided, you know what, if I'm going to really focus on climate change, I should probably work as a climate policymaker.
Right.
You know, at that point I'd done private sector and done academia, but I never worked in the public sector. So ever since last year, I actually work as a climate policymaker for the Climate Action Secretariat in the Ministry of Environment and Climate Change Strategy in BC.
Right on.
And that's in fact my main job right now. And I teach on the side.
Okay.
So all that, that's a long answer, but you know, I have a very unusual life path, because there's not a lot of academics that just quit a tenured position like I did.
No, definitely not. It's seen as success in our society, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, for me, it wasn't. It was just a cop out. Mm. It was becoming comfortably numb.
Sure. Sure.
And I would rather, you know, I now make much less money than I used to and probably have less authority and less recognition, but you know, I work on incredibly interesting things. I mean, I wish I could tell you a lot about it. There's confidentiality to consider, but you know, right now we're working on the green recovery and stimulus plan for BC.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm right in the middle of that. And then the other files I work on involve green building standards and fleet electrification and carbon sequestration is a real passion of mine. I'm particularly interested in biochar.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Right on. I'm down to talk biochar until the cows come home.
Yeah. Yeah. I had an episode on that actually. One of the originals. Yeah. Yeah. With the gentleman who was making it here. I forget his name, but yeah, one of the first episodes I made. Yeah.
It's nice.
It's an interesting product for sure.
I'm particularly interested. And also, I don't know if you know about bio coal, similar to biochar.
Okay.
You just sort of infuse the oils back into the biochar and it becomes more burnable.
Oh.
So it's, you don't get the carbon sequestration value, but it is more readily usable as an offset of coal, as an alternative coal. Anyway, so, you know, here I am, a climate policymaker and a part-time academic and someone who's really, really interested in local food systems. I'm also a very active gardener. I keep chickens and bees and have a big vegetable garden. And I have an electric vehicle and I bike around town and I'm just trying my darndest to live my values.
Yeah.
And be a part of the solution.
That's awesome. And it's hard for people, right? Like there's a lot of people, myself included. Like I live in Edmonton, one of the colder cities in the world. And I don't live close to work. I drive to work and I do, but I still feel very strongly about all those same positions, right? But it's something, again, it's something I'm working on, as I think everybody is, especially when it comes to, you know, our society as ingrained in fossil fuels and, you know, unsustainable living as we are. It's hard to shake. It's so comfortable, like you said, right? It's comfortably numb.
You know, and one of the real downsides, well, it's all a downside, one of the consequences of neoliberalism, which is, it's hard to explain in a soundbite, but neoliberalism is the economic mode that we've been in really since the 80s, you might even say since the 70s, which is, I think, had real skepticism towards the public sector, has emphasized the private sector. One of the things it does is that it atomizes us as a society. It breaks us down into our constituent parts and prevents us from understanding that it is really community that is responsible for finding solutions, not individuals.
Sure.
You know, this is why I think the people who are preppers and who think they're going to go off and get their hobby farm and survive the end of days or something is just crazy. I mean, we're all in this together.
Yeah.
We're all on the same planet. We're all in the same community. So it's not about you as an individual per se, as it is about all of us collectively as a community figuring out a path ahead. And that requires everyone. That's public sector, that's private sector, that's NGOs, that's academics, everyone.
Absolutely. Well, and I think in the time of COVID-19, it's become very apparent to everybody how much we need everybody for this to work, right?
Like
it was easy for people to, you know, look down on people in certain professions and that kind of stuff until you realize that like, no, you absolutely need those people for you to do your everyday things. You take it for granted, right? So it's, we're in this together. Like you said, that's totally true. Absolutely.
Mm. Yeah. Cause I mean, there's a lot of people who want to be living sustainably, but they can't figure out how to do it. And in a cold, like you're saying, in a northern climate like Alberta, it's particularly difficult because one's carbon footprint is just inherently large given the fact that you need so many heating days and there's a high grid emissions factor because you have thermal coal as your electricity source for a lot of it.
Yeah.
So anyway, what I was saying is that in Edmonton, it's particularly difficult. I mean, look at electric vehicles. The range doesn't work very well when it's 30 below.
No.
A vehicle doesn't go very far.
No.
Then, you know, you're only as clean as your electricity source and it's, mostly still coal-fired power plants.
Yeah.
In Alberta. So it's difficult. It's really hard. And so it requires, I think, really solid leadership to get us through these very difficult moments. And unfortunately, from my point of view, I'm not seeing good leadership in many parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's US, forget about it.
Yeah.
Alberta is a mess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, BC is doing all right, but could be doing better. And,
I think I want to start just a little bit with, just to provide some context for people who might not be super familiar with the idea of sustainability. I mean, it's one of those things that we hear all the time. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You hear it in every pop culture all the time. And I think people have their own ideas of it. But just quickly, how would you, if you were at a cocktail party and someone comes up to you, what do you do? What is like, and they say, oh, sustainability. They say, oh, okay, sustainability. But they, how would you describe it to them? How would you convince to them that that is the way forward for everybody, regardless of what your interests are?
Well, honestly, my response would like differ based upon who I'm talking to.
Of course. Let's say it's somebody who doesn't understand sustainability and is a very pro free market capitalist person.
Well, they're challenging. I start out by talking about economics. Okay. Like, you know, one of the things I do is I get called in to teach workshops and seminars at various universities. I do that remotely now.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I get called in to teach sustainability to corporate CEOs.
Okay.
From high powered folks who work at Fortune 500 companies. And in fact, I just did that a couple of weeks ago at a university in Chicago. I start out by talking about how costly climate change is. So that's maybe not a direct answer to your question on sustainability, but just entering into this conversation via climate change.
Mm-hmm.
I talk about the economics of it all. I don't go into it by saying, talking about environment. Maybe I might start out by talking about public health and the relationship between air pollution and asthma and deaths worldwide.
Right.
But I talk about economics, and I would start by talking about the Stern Review, which goes back to 2005, 2006,
mm-hmm.
Nicholas Stern, right? Eminent economist in Britain who was really the first to put together a team to try to figure out the costs of climate change, both abatement costs or mitigation costs, and then the cost of inaction.
Mm-hmm.
And so he found that the cost of inaction within a couple of decades would be per annum between 5% and 20% of GDP.
Right.
So anyone who even has a passing understanding of economics can understand that you cannot have a fiscally solvent society if you're spending one out of every $5 simply treading water, dealing with, sometimes literally treading water.
Right. Of course.
Dealing with climate change. And mm-hmm. then on the other end, in terms of mitigation and preventing the worst of climate change, because of course the climate has already changed. Let's not kid ourselves. We're right in the middle of it.
For sure.
The question is, how bad is it going to be? Mm-hmm. I mean, his initial estimate was 1% of GDP per annum, and he later doubled that to 2%.
Right.
So the point being is that any way you slice it, it's going to be very expensive, but the rational, fiscally responsible thing to do is to put money into it on the front end so you're not dealing with it and saddling your future self and later generations with just incomprehensible amounts of debt.
Yeah.
If not complete societal collapse.
Mm-hmm.
So when you put it in those terms, you start to get their attention. And I'm yet to meet anyone in any of these seminars who doesn't fundamentally grasp that point.
Sure.
I've even noticed somewhat anecdotally that climate skeptics have really, it's that phenomenon has really receded in the last 2 or 3 years.
It's getting tough to deny.
It is. And the polls bear that out, especially in Canada, a little bit less so in the US, but even there, it's just really hard. I mean, even family members of mine who were climate skeptics 5-6 years ago are changing their tune.
Mm-hmm. And which is great. I'm glad that they're doing that, right? It's yeah.
Yeah, I learned a really interesting term the other day. You know, Schadenfreude?
I don't.
You know, the,
no.
Oh, really?
Nope.
German term. It's like where you take some kind of pleasure from other people's miseries.
Okay.
Well, there's a new term that was coined, which was Cassandra Freude.
Okay.
Which references the ancient goddess Cassandra, who was blessed with the ability to know the future, but people would never listen to her.
Oh.
So Cassandra Freud is the feeling you have when you were right, but it really sucks that you were right.
Right.
You know, that's how I feel. It's a perfect term for people in the climate world. Yeah. It's like Cassandra Freud every day is how I feel. It's like, yeah, we've been talking about this shit for decades.
Yeah.
Now you people are just starting to listen.
Yeah.
Well, we're not spiking the football because it's not anything to celebrate.
Yeah.
No kidding. So that's how I feel about it. It's like, yeah, well, I mean, it was pretty clear some decades ago. Mm-hmm. Anyway. So sustainability, that's one of the ways I talk about it, is about like, just like economically being fiscally responsible as a society.
Yeah. Talk about the money, like that's people's attention for sure.
But it's fundamentally a triple bottom line philosophy. I would say is another way of explaining sustainability. It's about creating economic, social, and environmental well-being all at the same time, mm-hmm. and not seeing those issues as fundamentally divided.
Right. I mean,
whenever you're talking about environment, with rare exceptions, there are some exceptions, but in most instances, you're also talking about human beings and you're talking about the economy.
Yeah.
And when you're talking about economy, you're talking about the environment and you're talking about people. They're all interconnected. Mm-hmm. So the interconnectedness of the three, which by the way was once a controversial thought and now not so much. And then other important concepts in sustainability is the idea of limits. So that's one where a really, really pro-growth economic thinker struggles a bit, because our economic system is predicated upon the notion of endless growth.
Yeah.
And that growth is always good. And if an economy is growing, it is by definition a positive thing. And so that bumps up against ecological laws, which do not presume that growth is endless or always positive.
Right.
So, you know, that's where the historians come in, because there's a lot of evidence out there, as I'm sure you know, of societies that have overshot their ecosystems and their resources and have collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't want to find ourselves in a similar, even more spectacular situation.
Absolutely. Completely.
And then two other things. One, the importance of long-term planning. I mean, sustainability is about the long term.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about the current election cycle or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
You know, I always use the example of Germany with its Energiewende, its 50-year energy plan. You know, there's not a lot of societies that have 50-year plans of any kind.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and that requires long-term planning. It requires extensive levels of political agreement, consensus, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. that the next administration doesn't come in and just completely undo what the previous one did.
Exactly.
And then finally, resilience, the importance of resilience. And resilience is about whether or not you're talking about a society or an economy, or sorry, an ecosystem or human society. Resilience is about the ability to absorb disruption.
Mm-hmm.
It's about creating systems that are not vulnerable to various kinds of shocks, that can withstand those kinds of disasters, whether that disaster be from an ecosystem standpoint, something like a landslide or a flood or a fire. If you think about a forest, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
A resilient forest bounces back from the pine beetle,
mm-hmm.
or catastrophic floods or catastrophic fires. In fact, you know, a really smart forest figures out a way to benefit from fire. If we think about certain pine species that can only reproduce via fire, right? Mm-hmm. Which I'm sure you know more about than I do.
Yeah. You
know, is it jack pine or is it?
Arguably most of them, right? They're all serotonous cones. So they.
Serotonous cones.
Yeah. They all need heat.
So that's resilience. And then, you know, from the societal standpoint, it's like, are you able to absorb disruption? Or do you collapse under the weight of those disruptions? And if you do, then you're vulnerable.
Right.
You're a vulnerable society. And what we want to do is create a disaster-proof society. And so something like the pandemic has really ended up shining a light on some of our vulnerabilities.
Big
vulnerabilities
time.
Of healthcare systems. Maybe not as much in Canada, where we've weathered it pretty well. Mm-hmm. But in places like New York City or anywhere in the U.S. where there's been a shortage of PPE, there's been a shortage of ventilators, there's been people completely unwilling to wear masks or take it seriously.
Yeah.
Then on the food side, we've seen big disruptions. You know, I follow this stuff to our globalized food system. enormous disruptions.
Right.
I mean, it's we already knew that so much of agriculture is based upon immigrant labor, but yeah. I don't think we really quite figured that out, or the average person didn't wrap their brain around it until the pandemic happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, originally Canada, in fact, barred immigrants from immigrant farm workers from coming into the country in March, but had to quickly reverse their position on that because there's just a shortage of farm workers in Canada.
Yeah.
You know, they mainly in Canada, they mainly come from the Caribbean and Central America. And I've traveled across this country and met many migrant farm workers. Of course, the US, everyone knows about the US, but then, you know, I was reading about places like Sweden and Norway, like a big part of their farm labor force comes from the Ukraine. And then they couldn't get people in from the Ukraine because of COVID travel restrictions. And who's going to pick the food?
Yeah. We're living in a global economy, right? Like this is a global age. No one nation can stand alone. It's just not the way we work anymore.
Yeah. But I mean, I think another aspect of sustainability is about, at least for me, this might be just a bee in my bonnet though. It's about decentralization.
Sure.
Although I know it's not a bee in my bonnet because, you know, there's many, many influential thinkers, including E.F. Schumacher, Small is Beautiful, a book that, you know, an evergreen wise book from 1973, E.F. Schumacher, who was one of the chief economists for the National Coal Board in the UK, and had a very dramatic about face in life and got into what he called Buddhist economics. That was a hugely influential book in the 1970s and still influential in the sustainability movement. Small is Beautiful. I mean, all these folks today who are interested in growing their own food, getting back to the land, having their own chickens, shortening the supply chains between producer and consumer. I mean, I'm one of these people, but the entire community of people that I'm around in Victoria all share these values. And it's very much Small is Beautiful. So it's like, instead of relying on a big hydroelectric dam that's several hundred kilometers away and loses efficiencies because you're sending electricity long distances, well, how about micro turbines and solar PV and solar hot water and heat pumps on your own home? Mm-hmm. You know, instead of getting apples from Chile and New Zealand, grow your own apples. Instead of meat or eggs from a factory farm, raise your own meat and your own hens. I have hens in my backyard. A friend of mine who lives not 2 kilometers from here, right in the middle of Victoria, and he has a small lot. He's raising quail, rabbits, ducks, and chickens.
Right. Just loves
he
has it.
All, he loves it. He's got all of his own. He eats. He produces 100% of his own meat, produces 100%, more than 100% of his own eggs, most of his own vegetables and fruits. You know, that those are very much values of sustainability. And,
for sure.
And it's not to say that sustainability is anti-globalization per se, but there's this recognition that globalization creates vulnerabilities and it also has big, because of things like supply chain disruptions, but also there's a big carbon footprint there. And there's a lot of injustice behind the low price of commodities. And, you know, I mean, I think if we saw how our food was grown and our products were made, we'd be less likely to buy it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And there's some weird egg gag laws and all kinds of weird stuff like that. But so just to talk a little bit more about decentralization. So in your mind, what does that look like? If we were to move towards a decentralized economy or decentralized system, like not everybody's going to be able to or have the means by which to grow their own food or, create their own power or, So how do you go about doing that in a way that is not something that someone's just going to poo-poo immediately and go, oh, you're a dreamer, you know?
Well, I think that it happens, you know, going back to some of my earlier comments, I think it really goes back to community resilience. It's not so much about the individual household level. We don't want to overly atomize ourselves. But I mean, take, for example, district energy systems. I think that's a really good example of decentralization.
Okay.
There's examples all over the world now of communities of like neighborhood scale that is producing their own solar electricity or their own small run of river, for example. I mean, just take an example off the top of my head. There's an indigenous community up the Fraser River that now has a 50 megawatt run of river operation called Kanakabar. and they are producing more electricity than they need and they're selling it back to the grid. I think that's a really good example.
Right.
And there's actually quite a few indigenous communities in Canada that have essentially created energy sovereignty. You know, the Sauk Nation is another example out here with their solar just outside of Victoria. So it's not about just the individual household. It's about the community.
Yeah.
So I really like community energy projects and district energy systems, for example. And then when it comes to food, you know, we're just kind of coming out of the fog of a globalized food system that was really at its apogee from the 60s until around the early years of the 21st century.
Right.
You know, prior to 1955, most parts of the world were producing their own food, with some rare exceptions. Even BC was producing most of its own food. And going back further into the pre-war period, it was producing, you know, 90% plus of its own food. It was harder and more expensive to ship food. There's always been exceptions of certain things, but in terms of people's staples, most societies produce their own food. And whether that was hunted or gathered or grown, it just would have been inconceivable to have, you know, 90% of your food imported.
Yeah.
With rare exceptions. Mm-hmm. And that was flipped around due to globalization, due to cheap and abundant fossil fuels, cheap foreign labor. And it became possible to have, mutton from New Zealand become cheaper than mutton across the water from me on Salt Spring Island, which used to be the big sheep herding island.
It's interesting that you chose mutton as an example, but okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, any commodity you can think of, really.
Sure, right? Yeah. Just mutton's probably the last thing I would have thought about, but anyways.
some people like mutton, you know.
I've never tried it, so I'll have to give really? It a go. No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I think, anyway, the point I'm making is that over the last 15 years, people have realized the value of a localized food system. Mm-hmm. And you can measure that in a number of different ways. One is the revival of farmers markets. One is just the percentage of in-province or in-state food that people are consuming. And, you know, the local food movement has gone crazy. But still, a place like BC still produces less than half of its own food.
Right.
If you can believe that. And this is a province where there's 4.7 million hectares of agricultural land reserve land that's set aside for agriculture, not to mention the fact there's vast ocean resources, et cetera. I mean, it's even hard for me to figure out exactly. I've tried to figure out how much food we produce as a province. The highest estimate I've seen is 45%.
Okay.
But still, like, that means that we're still importing so much.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a shock to the system in the form of the pandemic, and people go, whoa. And I'm working on this stuff on the back end, working for the government, but all of a sudden food security is like, that's all we talk about now.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's on the radar in a big way. The premier just the other day met with a group of NGOs, talk about food security. Nobody was talking about it really prior to this.
No.
Except for me.
Some permaculturists, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. What does it look like? I mean, I think it looks like you have to value it. You have to measure it, right? If you don't value it and you don't measure it, it's just not going to happen in your society. And so as a society, I'm taking BC as an example, but use any, anywhere in North America that you want. You're not going to feed yourself as a society unless you value it, unless you pass legislation and create institutions and support networks to produce, you know, let's say 80 or 85% of your own food.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say that no imports would occur. You know, I think it makes sense to import things that we can't grow here, like coffee or chocolate, cacao. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But when I see snap peas from China, it makes me lose my mind.
Yeah.
Honestly, it's like you just go outside and grow it.
Right. For sure.
There's no climatic reason to do that. It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
It's illogical on so many levels.
Yeah.
So what, this is a long answer to your question, but what I want to see is localized energy production.
Yeah.
Localized food production, a revival of local manufacturing to the extent that we are able to do it. Mm-hmm. And to a certain extent, you're going to still rely on international supply chains. I mean, like not, I don't have the capacity to make a solar panel. You know, I don't have rare earth minerals and silicon and, you know.
Of course.
Right.
You don't have one of those in your backyard? Just yeah. Silicon but, mine?
Like, but we could be prioritizing and valuing something more like self-sufficiency.
Absolutely. So do you think there's, I mean, I know what you think, but we're going to get you to talk about it. I want to talk about like the economy a little bit more and where our current economic system falls short in terms of sustainability and mm-hmm. why that's dangerous, not just in the sense of climate change, but in, you know, the sense of true cost of commodities and true cost of things. And then how could sustainability become something that's, you know, a non-politicized, just common knowledge for everybody, something that everyone goes, yes, we need to be sustainable or we're screwed kind of thing, right?
There's so many different ways of entering into this conversation. I'll
leave it to you.
my brain is like spinning right now.
I'm sure you wrote a whole book on it. So
yeah. If I had to boil it down to one thing, honestly, mm-hmm. and this is, if I get back to writing books at some point, big philosophical books that I wish I could write, I think that if I could reduce the problems of Western civilization to one thing over the last 250 years, to one thing, it would be our obsession with quantification, our obsession with quantity, and our relative lack of understanding of quality.
Okay.
And that's a big statement, but the scientific method and the scientific worldview that's dominated our economy and our society and our lives, industrialism, modernity for the last 250 years, has very much been driven by quantification, mathematics, numbers, adding things up, more, bigger is better.
Mm.
And if you live in a worldview in which bigger is better, more is good, then the notion of endless growth just inherently makes sense. And so if I had to, again, this is oversimplifying things, but if I had to oversimplify things a bit, would be that sustainability is saying we need to bring quality into the conversation. We need to bring quality. In fact, quality needs to be the center of the conversation and quantification needs to be pushed a little bit to the margins. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that's not important, but it's actually not the main story.
Yeah.
So a sustainable economy means that people are happy and well-fed and are have access to democracy, have the ability to flourish. They live safe lives. They have high levels of satisfaction. They have mental health. They have physical health. They have community. They have spirituality. Their basic needs are met and more. That should be the objective of an economy.
Right.
Those conversations don't even enter into most discussions of economics. If you turn on CBC, you turn on MSNBC or whatever it may be, mm-hmm. it's stock market, it's GDP growth, it's trade imbalance. We're not talking about the actual things that we value. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the busyness of the economy.
Right.
And in a very narrowly quantified way that actually misses the target completely on what it is that we value. I think most people don't really care at the end of the day if the economy is bigger. What they care about is that their lives are good or their lives are better.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, until recently, I regret to inform your listeners that there has not even really been good ways of measuring what a qualitatively functional society looks like or economy. You know, the GDP has roots that go way back to the 19th century, but it really the methodology that formed for the modern day measure of the GDP goes back to 1937. Economist named Simon Kuznets. And even back then, he was warning that that it should not be taken as a stand-in for the health of an economy.
Sure.
It's just one way of measuring the busyness of an economy. But that's, of course, what it became. It became a stand-in for the economic health of an economy. And I think truly, truly to our detriment.
Yeah.
And this is borne out by people like Stern in the Stern Review, who very boldly says that climate change is the most spectacular form of market failure that the world has ever seen. And until I read that, it just hadn't really occurred to me to think about it in those terms. Climate change is market failure. Markets have failed us because they have generated ecological destruction and historically unfathomable levels of carbon and methane pollution or emissions,
right,
that have driven our species to the brink and other species as well. If that's not market failure, then I don't know what is. Mm-hmm. And
well, simply put, I mean, it's we've allowed things to be sold at subsidized prices because we failed to put the true cost of the impacts on society, right? And I think
that's right.
Yeah, and
absolutely.
That's the big thing that's missing. People figure, oh, it cost me this much to get it out of the ground or to do this thing, and so that's what it should cost, a little bit more than that. Yeah. They don't take into the impact on healthcare, on the environment, on
and let me be clear too, though, I'm not opposed to private enterprise by any means. You know, I know I spent a lot of time talking about triple bottom line economics to the private sector, but what I'm going on about is this sort of pig-headed notion that the only way to have a healthy economy is for it to get bigger. And so one of the examples I talk about in the book, and you could take literally any number of examples, there's just one I took, mm-hmm. was the Exxon Valdez oil spill.
Yeah, that was a shocker for me. Yeah. You know, explain that.
And well, every time there's an oil spill or any kind of ecological disaster, it ends up increasing the GDP because, you know, there's lawsuits, there's cleanup crews, there's consultant fees, there's economic activity is generated via disaster.
Right.
And you could call that
$2 billion. I think you said
$2 billion approximately. And that's actually much lower than, so I mean, I could take in other examples, like for instance, Deepwater Horizon, where there was much more economic activity than that. So the point being is that when you have this narrow-minded focus on GDP and this narrow-minded focus on quantifying growth or quantifying an economy, an oil spill shows up as a positive in your ledgers.
Right.
Oil spills are good.
Yeah.
But only a buffoon would say that an oil spill is good. And that and we are forced into that absurd situation via our economic methods and our preoccupation with growth. And certainly growth has obviously had its advantages. I mean, there's a very high standard of living in the North. Mm-hmm. But at what expense? At what expense? The expense of climate change and ecological destruction. It's simply put unsustainable.
Yeah.
You could look at that from any number of points of view, including ecological footprint analysis.
Yeah.
And so what I'm arguing for endlessly is to change our values and our metrics. And there are now many different ways of measuring an economy that go beyond the narrow calculus of biggering or diminishing the size of an economy.
Right.
And those include the genuine progress indicator, or the index of sustainable economic welfare, happy planet index, gross domestic happiness, ecological footprint. These are all different methods, and there are others. I mean, just to take one example, the GPI, genuine progress indicator. And by the way, well, I'll tell the other story in a minute. The genuine progress indicator essentially starts with the GDP. Okay. Starts with GDP, but then it adjusts for various other kinds of costs, including healthcare costs, criminal justice costs, environmental costs, that sort of thing.
Right.
And so it changes the calculus by presuming that not all economic activity is positive. Right.
Right. Yeah.
That some of it is what Herman Daly called uneconomic growth. Mm. So the GPI, if you look at the U.S., I mean, your listeners can Google this. If you Google GPI of the U.S. Versus GDP, well, GDP has been sort of slightly going up since over the last 20, 30 years, but the GPI has been flatlined since the 70s.
Oh, really?
It's actually gone slightly down. Huh. Yeah. And you know, the average American is actually doing worse off in many cases than they were 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so, in some places, real wages are actually lower than they were 4 years ago. Real wages, like not inflation adjusted.
Right.
In places like Detroit, for instance, or Baltimore.
Right. That ties in really well to like the whole idea. One of the big ideas you discussed in this book was how social justice and sustainability are one and the same and how they're tied.
Yeah,
I'd love for you to talk about that a little more and just to kind of explain that concept, because the idea that you talked about at the very beginning here about how you know, social justice and economic activity and sustainability, how all these things are, you know, they're three sides of, you know, three sides of the same pyramid kind of thing. It's hard for people to see that. It's, you know what I mean? Like money is, money is something that people can really quantify. They can really say like, hey, like I got this much, I'm successful, I'm doing well. So they apply that to the country and they think, okay, they must be doing okay. So how do how could you explain that relationship a little bit better so people can maybe understand how those are interrelated and, you know, change their ideas on things?
Yeah. I mean, it's a really good point and a really good question. I mean, I've spent a bit of time in this podcast talking about economic well-being and talking about environmental well-being, but I haven't really talked about social, and it's the other leg of the tripod. And it's of course related to environment and related to the economy. But I mean, here's the thing that growth hides essentially is that it doesn't say anything about the distribution of wealth whatsoever. Right.
Right.
I mean, you could have, you know, a billionaire, the wealth of a billionaire adds to the GDP, but it doesn't tell us anything about how that wealth is distributed to people in that society. There, so another method to look at is what's called the Gini coefficient, which is a measure of the distribution of wealth in society. And, you know, the US doesn't show up very well in the Gini coefficient because there's an enormous gap between the haves and the have-nots.
Right.
And so, yes, a sustainable society is one in which people have not only enough to eat and that there's self-sufficiency and basic needs are being met, but that there's relative levels of equality as well. And I don't know if you can quantify those in really easy ways, but the, you know, I mean, I'm sure you've read some of the statistics about Jeff Bezos and his wealth.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you can make, I wish I remember what it was off the top of my head, but it was like, you can make $5,000 every day from the year 1700 to the present and still not even have a fraction of his wealth.
Yeah. It was, it was something like that. it's unfathomable.
Or his equity.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, a sustainable society is not just one where people are producing their own food and electricity and that sort of thing, but it's also where there is relative equality. And relative equality is also hugely important when it comes to democracy as well, because when there are huge imbalances in wealth in a society, there also tends to be huge imbalances in access to politicians and influence in the political arena. Whereas if you have relative equality, that is more equitably distributed. I mean, I think one of the smartest things Canada and BC separately have done over the last couple of years is curb donations from corporations and unions.
Right.
I mean, it's unfathomable coming from the US that would happen. And yet I think it's the single most important thing that you can do, frankly, to strengthen your democracy. And that happened in BC in 2017 as part of the agreement between the Greens and the NDP, to cut off all union and corporate donations. Prior to that, it was like the Wild West here of political donations.
Yeah.
And now, you know, the max donation is $1,200-ish. You can't buy that much influence with $1,200. So, that is, I think, very much that's legislation that to me supports social well-being and social equality and social justice and is as important as economic well-being or environmental well-being.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a hard one to try and tie those knots together so to understand, right? Like it took me the whole book to really understand the argument behind sustainability incorporating all aspects of life, right? Like it's interesting and it's hard to go through, but the book does a good job of explaining it for sure. And
yeah, thank you.
Yeah, no, it was really, really well done. Like one of the things that I can't remember if this was a direct quote that you said in the book or not, but it was, in theory, a socially sustainable society is one where citizens are content to live modest lives of value and satisfaction and health over money and consumption. And it's a weird one because it'd be easy for people to point at that and go like, oh yeah, that sounds like communism or something stupid like that, right? But really what we're saying is just,
Communists weren't that happy though.
No, I know that's what people would say, misunderstanding what's going on, right? But how do we get people to start to look at like happiness and like, you know, real quality of life as success of a nation, a success, you know what I mean?
I wish I had the answer to that one.
Over just money. Right now it's just everything's money. Everything's, if you have more money, then you're successful. You're doing well. Like it's a weird problem that we've got ourselves into.
To be honest with you, I'm really hoping that the pandemic turns out to be the turning point in world history that I think it could be and it needs to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm involved in not only in government and academia, but in all aspects of my life. This is all anyone can talk about, you know, the various forums that I'm a part of and organizations and whoever it is, we're all having the same conversation, which is what is it about this pandemic that, how has it forced us to reevaluate our priorities and our values? And what are the positive aspects of it that we want to maintain after the pandemic, if it wanes? Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously there's been enormous loss and economic devastation and death. I've known people personally who've died. But it's this opportunity to slow down and say, we need to rethink everything. We just, and the protests and the riots that are going on in the US, I think are just one emanation of that.
People are frustrated.
Of that. It's just like, we cannot go back to the status quo. The status quo is over.
Yeah.
I think it's over. Mm-hmm. Like travel is going to be next to impossible after this pandemic. I mean, anywhere you go, you're gonna have to quarantine for 2 weeks. It's going to make it really hard to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. You can't just fly to Mexico anymore. At least not anytime soon.
Right.
And, you know, the supply chains have been greatly disrupted. Many, many, many jurisdictions around the world are saying, whoa, well, this is a wake up call. We need to be producing our own food. We need to increase our systemic resilience. We need to reduce our vulnerabilities. We need to just rethink everything.
Yeah.
And what's happened in my world, and I imagine yours as well, is that it's forced you to slow down.
Yeah.
And at least here it's forced me and everyone I know to spend lots more time at home, lots more time with their family, and just getting in touch with what it is they actually care about. Mm-hmm. And it's really not difficult to figure out what it is that people care about all over the world. They want meaningful work. They want their spirituality. They want access to their family. They want nutritious food. They want clean air and water. It's not rocket science by any means. There's obviously some variability from place to place, but there's general consensus about what it is that people need to have high levels of life satisfaction. Mm-hmm. And so my hope is that this pandemic, people come away from it and they say, work-life balance really matters.
Yeah.
You know, there's a big push in BC and in other parts of the world to have a 4-day work week.
Yeah.
For instance. And that's partly for increased job sharing, so more people can have employment, but it's also because most people just don't give a shit about the rat race anymore.
Yeah.
They just don't care.
Yeah.
And I think the pandemic has really shown a light on that. It's like, what are we on this treadmill for exactly? Yeah. Like what is, you know, that's why I really think that people should take a look at things like, gross domestic happiness or happy planet index. Cause you figure, you know, it's done, you know, there's always reason to quibble about the methods, but essentially what you find is that a lot of countries that are the richest are not the happiest.
Right.
There's some exceptions to that. You know, the Nordic countries are pretty happy, but a lot of the happiest countries are actually more like the second world countries. And then countries that are quite poor are also unhappy. Right. You know, it's not to say the poorer you get, the happier you get. There's a sort of sweet, there's a sweet spot, you know, of a Costa Rica, of a Jamaica, of a Bahamas, parts of Southeast Asia, where they actually have very low carbon footprints. You know, the annual household income is fine and people have high levels of life satisfaction.
Yeah.
Well, aren't they the rich ones in fact?
Right.
And so, you know, your question about how do we shift our mindset in this? I think it comes from events like this that are thrust upon us externally. The pandemic was thrust upon us and forced us to reassess. And I don't think anybody wants to go back to the status quo of any sort. It's like, it's done.
Yeah. So how do you propose, or I mean, you know, if you were to have the reins of this thing, how would you propose we take advantage of the opportunity that this pandemic brings? I mean, it's provided a lot of or a lot of time for people to think about how they want to live their lives and what they want to be doing with their time.
So many takeaways. Yeah, I mean, one is the universal basic income, mm-hmm. I think is a really important one, because there are a lot of people who are out of work, they're underemployed, they have intermittent work. And what I think is sort of screwed up is that we only talk about a universal basic income when the shit hits the fan and huge amounts of people are out of work. Well, why is it then that people who are self-employed or work for employers that, or don't pay into EI, how come they don't get EI? You know, like the CERB, some version of the CERB needs to stay around, essentially. Right. Like, right. I understand it's not fiscally sustainable to have, like, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of bailout every month. We can't do that, obviously. Yeah. But some version of that needs to remain. And, you know, I'm an historian. Go back to the New Deal. Go back to the Marshall Plan. Like, the social safety net that still exists in Canada, still exists in you know, Western Europe, not so much in the US. Where do social safety nets come from? They don't generally come from the time of milk and honey. They come from the time of difficulty and privation. Mm-hmm. When people look to the government and they go, you know what, things are bad, we need your help. We need to help each other, in fact, since we're paying for all this via our own taxes. Yeah. And people are in trouble right now. Mm-hmm. You know, many of the people I know are out of work. So I think a society that's there for each other, that has an equitable distribution of wealth, inherently makes sense to me. Then second of all, completely rethinking food. We need to rethink our food systems and other kinds of basic goods as well. I mean, I'd like to see, one of the things I'd like to see more of is Canadians manufacturing their own clothes. Almost all of our clothes come from abroad.
Right.
Why? We could be producing textiles here.
Yeah.
You know, we could be growing flaxseed to make linen. We have sheep. We can make wool. It's not that hard.
I'd say the answer to that question would probably be dollar bills, y'all.
Yeah. But here's the thing, you know, I mean, look at the oil sands. Oil sands weren't even profitable until about 2000 because they were heavily, heavily, heavily financed by provincial and federal governments. Mm-hmm.
That's a big thing, I think. Sorry, I'd just like to stop you for a second, because I think that's something that's hugely misunderstood in our society, where you hear lots of people that are very, very, for whatever reason, behind oil and gas and totally against renewables. And they'll say things like, they're trying to be reasonable, right? They're like, well, we're thinking about this and I'm all for renewables. They just can't be subsidized. And you're like, okay, but I think there's been a misunderstanding that people think that oil and gas
has been a very big misunderstanding.
Right. So can you clear that up just a little bit?
Sure. I will clear that up, because, I mean, first of all, you and I clearly know different people, because nobody in my world would ever say that. But
you see videos on YouTube and stuff when you try to look up how the other side thinks. I try to figure this out. And
What's funny about modern capitalism is that we sort of convince ourselves that we have sort of free trade and that governments are on the sidelines and it's survival of the fittest and it's supply and demand, and nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, I would love to actually see for 5 years what actual free trade would look like, in which the government did not support any industry at all whatsoever.
Right. True. Good point.
Let's just see. You guys can have 5 years and we'll just see what it looks like.
No subsidies.
I mean, I read in 2018 an excellent work by a guy named Donald Hughes on the energy sector in Canada. You know, it's a fairly technical report, but pretty readable. And he cited there a bit from the IMF showing the estimated annual contribution that every Canadian makes to oil and gas sector. And I wish I remember the exact number, but it's approximately $1,300 per year.
Yeah.
Something like that. Well, multiply 1,300 times 37 million.
Yeah.
It's an astronomical number.
Yeah.
And that comes from direct subsidies, tax breaks, but also, you know, building infrastructure for oil and gas, building roads, you know, sending out electrical, sending out, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Power lines.
Right.
Out to developments. Like, there's all manner of ways in which the government, provincial and federal, subsidize oil and gas. Mm-hmm. And that, as a result, has kept oil and gas profitable, made it profitable. So, and that goes back at least to the 50s, if not before. So this whole notion that like government shouldn't bet on this industry or that is complete hogwash.
Yeah.
We've been betting on fossil fuels for 70 years at least. And as a result, it's allowed the sector to remain viable. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because we become completely reliant on fossil fuels, but then we only support fossil fuels.
Yeah.
If we put even a fraction of that into renewables, we would be getting off of fossil fuels very quickly, and we'd be creating good jobs for people like Albertans, mm-hmm. you know? And there are a lot of opportunities for renewables in Alberta. I mean, my own sense is that fossil fuels are a twilight industry. Mm-hmm. It's declining whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
And my concern is that if Alberta doesn't figure this out very, very, very quickly and start rapidly diversifying its economy towards agriculture and renewables and tech and academia and whatever else, it's going to be devastation in a few decades. Alberta will look like Detroit.
It's totally in our best interest and everyone's best interest. Like, yeah, you're not going to be making, you know, $100,000 a year out of high school working on the rigs, but on, you know what I mean? There's going to be lots of other jobs in energy exactly. renewables and that we can actually do. So could you explain why subsidizing renewables makes sense and is an acceptable investment sure. for, you know, taxpayers to make versus subsidizing sure. oil and gas and why that is a mistake?
I mean, number one is because there's jobs. There's a huge number of jobs available. And, right. I mean, Germany has 400,000 jobs in its renewables sector. Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of that's from companies like Siemens. So there's jobs at stake. There's the climate at stake. I mean, you know, the oil sands is Canada's largest contributor to greenhouse gases. It's the world's largest industrial development. Mm-hmm. It's an embarrassment internationally for us. And I get that it supports many, many people and that it's important to Alberta's economy, and no one would disagree. But we need an effective plan to transition away from it and use that capital. That's the thing, right? All this capital, I mean, right now oil prices have tanked. So there's, you know, it's in some instances more expensive to hold on to the oil than it is to even, it's not even worth it to dig it out of the ground at the moment.
A couple of weeks ago, we were paying people to take it off our hands.
Yeah. It's just unbelievable. Yeah. But, you know, so what I'm saying is that there's nonetheless has been enormous capital generated from oil and gas over the last, you know, several decades. What are we doing with that capital? Mm-hmm. How are you investing it into long-term prosperity and long-term wealth? Yeah. If you're just putting it back into a twilight industry, you're just going to dissipate all of that capital.
Yeah.
What that capital needs to go towards a sustainable economy, and fossil fuels, any way you slice it, are not sustainable.
Yeah.
So investing in renewables makes sense because number one, we continue to have energy produced in Canada rather than having to import it at some point in the future, mm-hmm. which would be disaster. Number two, it creates jobs. Number three, it's a low carbon economy. And number four, it's just proper long-term planning.
Yeah.
So that doesn't mean that government necessarily needs to be throwing millions of dollars at whatever harebrained technology comes up. And believe me, I see proposals for this stuff in my work at Climate Action Secretariat. But, you know, if I were in charge of everything, I think it would be really interesting to have a crown corporation that evaluates proposals from the renewable sectors and invest in it.
Right.
Invest in it.
Yeah.
It's not a subsidy in that sense. It's an investment.
Yeah.
It's an investment in your community.
Absolutely.
So, I think it's like probably the top priority that we could have in Canada. And if you look at what BC is talking about and what the feds are talking about, I don't know. I don't follow Alberta as much as I used to, but at least in my province and federally, the entire conversation is about low carbon, like build back better is what we call it here. It's going to be a low carbon green economy.
We're doubling down on oil over here.
And it just doesn't make any logical sense.
So yeah, it's weird for me, like living here and seeing, like, I have friends and family who work in the oil industry, and yeah, they're really hurting, and they need jobs and they need support. And
yep.
But they seem to still think that, like, it's okay. Oil's going to be back. We'll have our jobs back. We need them. Like, I support it. And they don't see the opportunity elsewhere. And I know that's not on them. That's on the society as a whole for creating the system that we have. But it's also, like, how do we start to shift that focus in a place like Alberta, where we are so oil centric, into
good question.
Seeing the other side? How can we, you know what I mean? How can we benefit? We don't have to do, like, people can, you know, benefit from this changeover. It doesn't have to be everyone's going to be out of work, right?
You have to retrain people and support other industries. I mean, BC did that in the 90s when there was forestry workers who were out of work. There was a retraining program to get them into the trades and get them into carpentry.
Right.
A buddy of mine who's a forester was talking to me about it. I can't remember what the name of the program was, but many of his friends out in the Kootenays who were out of work foresters or worked in mills took the government up on it and they became carpenters. So that's an example. You have to help people get from point A to point B. I mean, one of the things that could be done right now in Alberta, number one is the wind sector. Wind turbines are growing, right? So I would be shifting people into that, helping, you know, get people set up a program for out of work oil and gas workers at NATE, for instance.
Yeah.
Northern Alberta Institute of Technology, for those who don't know.
Yeah.
How about free, completely free to be retrained as a wind turbine technician? Mm-hmm. Or you have enormous remediation of soil that needs to happen in Alberta from abandoned oil and gas wells. And according to the Supreme Court of Canada, in their new ruling, which happened a few months ago, last year actually, investors are not allowed to be paid out on oil and gas investments on until abandoned wells are sealed off and the soil is remediated.
Yeah, right.
So who's going to do all that work? Mm-hmm. The feds have been talking about this. I think that's great. That's, put out of work oil and gas workers into things that have positive environmental, social, and economic dimensions to them.
Well, and that was kind of my point. I'm like, I see, cause I'm from a small town, Slave Lake, middle of Alberta, northern Alberta. And I see currently when I go back, I see the hurt there, right? And it would hurt me infinitely to see that town turn into a ghost town because oil and gas died out, right? And so how can I would argue that it's the government's responsibility. Like the government, we put ourselves into the situation. The government put us into this situation. And they need to be responsible for helping people in small towns get retrained and have jobs that are still in their hometown, right?
And they're doubling down on oil and gas. And here's the other thing that's happened under the Ralph Klein administration. I don't know if you remember those years.
Oh, but
they got rid of all the royalties too to try to, this is part of neoliberalism. It's creating beneficial market conditions for private sector. Mm-hmm. But as a result, the public sector didn't get any of those royalties or tax revenues. And so,
it's weird. It's so strange.
Alberta doesn't even make that much money off of oil and gas. And so it's not like, it makes some money, but it was once making much more.
Yeah.
And so this is a perfect example of an unsustainable economy that could have been a sustainable economy by rolling that capital and that revenue into industries that are likely to be around for decades, if not centuries.
But I don't know, man. Back in Ralph Klein's days, we all got a $500 check because we balanced the budget. So, I mean, that was a good use of our time, right? We all went and spent it on cigarettes and liquor. And it boosted the GDP.
Exactly. But here's the thing is that, when people get out of work, too, on a more serious note, right? I mean, look at a place like Detroit. I don't know if you know anything about Detroit. I mean, that's where automobiles are made, right?
Yeah.
And so real wages, literally real wages, the actual amount that people made in Detroit was higher in the 70s than it is now.
Wow.
Not adjusted for inflation, the actual wages. And it was a working class town, partly African American, partly white. And what happened was when the auto industry began to decline, I mean, it's still there, but it's not what it once was.
Yeah.
A lot of the whites left the city. And Detroit went from being this working class black area to being a ghetto. Ghettos are created. And with it comes drug addiction, violence, mental illness, suicide, domestic violence, opioid addiction. I mean, if you look at the people most likely to be addicted to opioids right now, it's not homeless people, actually. It's men in the trades. Between the ages of 35 and 55 are the most likely to become addicted and die of overdose from fentanyl right now. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that. No.
Yeah. There's this notion that it's like druggies on the street.
Right.
It's actually men in the trades who are kind of weekend warriors, or they hurt their back on the job, or they got laid off and they're depressed and they end up on pills and one thing, leads to the next and you've overdosed.
Yeah.
So that's also a consequence of a really dysfunctional economy, as I see it. And I wouldn't be surprised if opioid addiction is on the rise in Alberta.
Yeah, I think it is. I don't know that for certain, but this is part of what frustrates me so much. And I'm not an economist. I don't know a lot about this, but just my own anecdotal feelings about it is like we seem to be doubling down on a resource that we know has failed us, but mm-hmm. yet we continue to go, well, no, it'll turn out. And I have a hard time rectifying that thought process, besides the fact that there's a huge portion of our population is completely dependent on the oil and gas sector. And we don't want those people to go without. You want them to be thriving the same as everyone.
Well, I'll tell you the unpopular thing to say about Alberta, that we've turned into a long discussion about Alberta here. I hope listeners, you know, care about the province. I care about the province, even though I haven't lived there for a number of years. I still do care about it. The unpopular reality, as I see it, is that Alberta's economy, if it shifts away from oil and gas, simply cannot support 5 million people.
Yeah.
It cannot. No. It's quote unquote natural population shouldn't be that high.
Yeah.
I mean, if there was agriculture and tech sector and academia and renewables and everything else that there is going on in the province, it could probably support 2 or 3 million people.
Yeah. Well, the most classical economist will say that, like, or I forgot what I was going to say. I just lost it completely, but you need a diversified economy. Like to be completely dependent on one resource, you're begging for collapse and catastrophe.
Well, and also 1 to 2 million people live in Alberta probably have to go back to the provinces that they came from, unfortunately.
Right.
People are going to have to go back to the Maritimes. They're going to have to go back to BC. So that's going to have a domino effect on other provinces, right? Because people left the Maritimes for a reason, because another industry, fishing, collapsed. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, you know, one maybe place to end this conversation, since I should probably get going here in a few minutes, is talking about the bioeconomy,
right?
And bring it back to forestry, mm-hmm. because I really want to see sustainable forestry practices, mm-hmm. and I haven't really seen it so well in BC, where we've actually been under the current government, we've actually expedited the rate at which we're cutting down our old growth forests. Mm-hmm. But I do think well-managed forests offer an opportunity both for a circular economy, a sustainable economy, for long-term wealth, and for good jobs.
Of course.
Because you've had mill closures, you've had, you know, you have the loss, the just tremendous ecological loss of 1,500-year-old forests.
Mm-hmm. And I would call that ancient growth, not old growth, just to be clear. Like in Alberta, old growth is, you know, you're 100, 200, 300 years old. Whereas when you're talking about, you know, giant trees on the coast, we're talking, that's ancient growth.
That's right. Ancient growth is a good way of putting it. And you know, it's not even necessarily giant trees too here. Have you been out to Vancouver Island? Do you know the island very well?
Not really well, but I've been there. Yes.
Well, if you go out by the Juan de Fuca Trail,
okay,
which is not very far outside of Victoria and beyond Souk. Mm-hmm. You know, I could drive there an hour and a half. And you go up into the subalpine. You go up from the coast. Just go up logging roads. Not very far even. You know, drive 20 minutes, 30 minutes up. You're in a completely different ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And it's snowy through May up there. Mm-hmm. And it's a different world. It's boggy. And there's frogs up there, and there's crowberry, and there's actually some of the oldest trees on the island are up there. But they're not the biggest trees, mm-hmm. right? Because the nutrient profile, it's boggy, a lot of kind of crumholtzy trees, and it's mainly mountain hemlock and yellow cedar.
Right.
And it's never been logged up there because it's just inoperable. Mm-hmm. And you have these trees that sometimes are not, you know, much bigger than the diameter of a person, and they might be 1,000 years old.
Well, the oldest tree in the world that's living today is that bristlecone pine, Methuselah, I think, mm-hmm. and it's like, I don't even know how tall it is, like 12 feet tall. And just this gnarly.
Is that in Nevada?
I think it's in California. I think, I don't know exactly. It's a kind of a mystery. People know, but it's not public knowledge.
They don't tell people where it is.
No. But yeah.
But the point I'm making is that in BC, we have, and I don't know, Alberta probably too, but there is more than enough second and third growth forest out there to actually have a triple bottom line functional, forest sector.
That's a whole other conversation that I could go deep into with you, but I don't know if we have the time.
But I mean, I don't know if we have the time, but I mean, you know, very briefly, going back to a more localized economy, why is it that we're shipping off raw logs to Asia and the US?
Right.
Why?
There's jobs
It makes absolutely no sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's again, globalization and neoliberalism at the expense of localized well-being.
Right.
In BC, we should be producing manufactured and value-added goods out of our forestry products. Our, it's just absurd.
Yeah, absolutely
absurd.
Yeah,
mismanaged forest, mismanaged forestry sector, mismanaged mills. All this has come to a head, mm-hmm. right? So I would like to see a revival of a bioeconomy. And you know, I'm not that hot on RNG, renewable natural gas, but I do think that biochar and is phenomenal. You know, you've already done a podcast on biochar, but for people who don't know, I mean, it's essentially cooking any carbon at a very, very high temperature and cooking everything out of it that's not carbon, and then you're left with almost a pure carbon mass that's recalcitrant carbon that doesn't break down very easily. You can lock carbon in for centuries to millennia.
Yeah.
And I've seen this in South America because they have a soil down there that you might have heard of called Terra Preta.
Yes, yeah.
And it's a man-made soil made out of biochar and other soil amendments and inputs that I won't get into. But essentially, there's the oldest biochar that's been found in Amazonia is 9,000 years old.
Wow.
It's the same carbon just sitting there.
Yeah.
So you want to talk about carbon sequestration.
That
would help. So one of the things that we've done in the province is we've calculated how much carbon could be sequestered mm-hmm. by a biochar. And it's just astronomical numbers. I mean, you could, in theory, reverse climate change via biochar if you had it on a very mass scale.
Quite the operation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But even things like, you know, building with wood, mass timber framing.
Yeah.
We're not doing very much of that.
It's getting bigger. It's getting bigger. It is growing.
It is getting bigger. I mean, there's a building at UBC called Brock Commons.
Yes.
That's 10 stories or something like that.
Yeah.
That's mass timber.
I think it was the first in the world to get that tile. Mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that locks in an enormous amount of carbon.
Yeah.
Too.
Well, and fire resistance and all kinds of benefits uh-huh. that come with it. And like you said, it's renewable, right? Like forestry done right is it's a renewable resource and we need to be taking advantage of that, right?
That's absolutely right. You know, the funny thing here is that like the new radicalism in some ways is living like people did 100 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
More without as much colonialism or racism. But you know, if I were to talk to my great grandma and say, you know, I'm picking my own berries and I'm making my own butter and I've got chickens and I want to use local wood, you know, she would have said, okay.
Why?
Congratulations.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then her kids would have said, why don't you go to university and, you know, become an engineer.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and that's what partly what's so interesting to me about the sustainability movement. In a lot of ways, it's just about getting back to our roots and just simplifying things.
Right.
And finding simple pleasures in the meeting our basic needs. You know, I mean, some of my greatest joys right now in life are raising bees and chickens and raising kids and playing music and having friends in my own neighborhood and doing all the stuff that I've learned to do over the last 10 years that I didn't grow up doing. You know, I now pick chanterelles and I make my own butter from raw milk and we bake bread and we do the whole nine yards. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, it's endlessly enjoyable to me.
Right. And it might not be for everybody. That doesn't mean that I think if everybody took it seriously, sustainability, and just thought about what they could do in their own lives to just make small, slight little adjustments, it would have an infinite effect on climate change, on uh-huh. the health of our world and of the people in our world, right? Like it's something that's, I don't feel like it's that complicated, really.
It's just not like, that complicated.
It's no, just, it's like, it's become complicated because we've made it so.
It's like, figure out what actually pleases you and then just do that. And don't be afraid to give some things up in life. You know, I've stopped flying and I don't miss it. I don't miss it. I can't say categorically that I'll never fly again. I might have to fly at some point, but I've essentially stopped flying.
Yeah.
And I don't miss it. I can go and explore the beaches of BC. I can go to the Kootenays. I don't really, at this point, it's just not morally sustainable.
Sure.
To, be on a cruise ship, dragging people's asses around the Pacific and polluting as the equivalent of a million cars, or just because I feel a sense of entitlement, I want to go to Mexico twice a year. I mean, we also have enormous privilege and entitlement.
Huge. Yeah.
That's, and I can't remember who said it, but you know, when you're accustomed to privilege, equality feels like oppression.
Yeah.
That's some wisdom right there. And, so in a lot of ways, it's just sort of shedding that sense of entitlement and privilege and just living a smaller, simpler, more localized life that's based on love and gratitude and appreciation and community and family. And just being satisfied with those things and getting off, I'm starting to sound like a Buddhist here, but honestly, I mean, that's why, Schumacher talks about Buddhist economics. It's like, you got to get off the treadmill of desire, of always wanting more stuff. Mm-hmm. It's not actually what deeply satisfies people at the end of the day.
Yeah. It's hard to recognize that though.
Yeah.
Feels like more stuff is going to make us happier. That little endorphin rush.
Well, maybe the pandemic helps us realize that that was actually just an illusion.
Yeah, hopefully it will. Absolutely. Well, this is a great conversation, man. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. Yeah, thanks so much.
I really enjoyed it and I appreciate the time.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thanks a lot for listening, guys. I hope you enjoyed that. I know I learned a lot. Definitely check out his book, Sustainability of History. It is so great. I listened to the audiobook and it was awesome. I really, really enjoyed it. And lots of good information there to make you think differently about the world and how we do things and how it would be beneficial to maybe shift to a different method. And it wouldn't be all that complicated, I don't think. So I say that as if I know anything about it. But I'm hopeful. So yeah. Thanks a lot for listening, guys. And, we'll see you next time. Remember to tell a friend, share it on social media, rate and review. Anything you guys can do to help spread the word about this podcast. If you enjoyed it, I would really appreciate it. Word of mouth is the best. So thanks a lot, guys. If you guys have any questions or concerns, shoot me an email, yourforestpodcast@gmail.com, and I'll get back to you. I always do. So, let me know what you think. See you next time.